Hello, this is Jim Copeland, Director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to pointoflaw.com's third podcast under our Law, Litigation, and State Power series featuring Richard Epstein, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute, and a visiting scholar with us here at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research this fall. Our topic for today is the new antitrust, re-examining Microsoft and other consent decrees. So the question I want to begin with, Professor Epstein, is what is a consent decree?
Well, a consent decree turns out to be a cross between a settlement by way of contract and a final judgment through a court. Essentially, the government will usually sue a private firm for some kind of violation of the antitrust laws and wishes to contain continuing jurisdiction over that firm once the case is settled. And what happens is that a judicial ratification of the decree allows for that continuous oversight and thus makes the enforcement much easier than it might otherwise have been. And the key question is always, what kinds of cases do you need to have consent decrees and how should they be worded?
Well, you asked the question, so go ahead and give us the answer, Professor.
Well, the first thing is you almost never need a consent decree if monetary damages are an appropriate remedy. So that consent decrees are almost always brought in response to a government action, which is designed to see a structural change in the way in which businesses are to be done. And with the antitrust laws, it turns out that, generally speaking, that the cases in which this turns out to be most important are those in which there's a claim that a dominant firm inside an industry has, by unilateral practice, engaged in certain tactics which have improperly foreclosed or excluded its rivals. And the question that the government always wants to ask is, what should we require of this firm in order to deal with the so-called threat that is posed under the antitrust laws?
Well, I call this the new antitrust, but as I learned today in your luncheon lecture, these consent decrees have been going on for quite some time. What are some examples of consent decrees before we get to Microsoft that have occurred historically?
Well, I think in many ways the sort of the two most interesting cases in the pre-modern period are first the Packers case, in which there was actually a horizontal agreement to divide markets, in this case with respect to the provision of various meat products. And what the consent decree did was to overreach by insisting that the companies not only stay out of collusion in the meat business, but they couldn't even compete in other markets like the grocery industry. So essentially what happened is that the antitrust decree, by going far further than the violation, had very profound anti-competitive effects with respect to the way in which the grocery business, for example, was going to be conducted. And the great vice of this decree was it had the wrong design, and it lasted for about 40-odd years, when generally speaking, the useful life for an antitrust decree is probably in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 years. The other case, which in many ways is more symptomatic of the perversity that can take place in this, involved the United Shoe Machinery Company, which merged in 1899 and after a series of nonstop government litigation was eventually broken up to its own ruination in 1969. No, you did not mishear me. It's a 70-year period. And the merger itself was essentially designed to get rid of the holdout problems that came when all the patents needed to make a pair of shoes were held by different companies, and the merger was basically a patent pool of complementary patents that massively increased efficiency. The objection that the government took was not to the merger itself, at least after the first litigation, but was to the contractual terms that were imposed by United Shoe on its customers, most of which were designed to enforce the exclusivity of its machinery, and this was thought to be a violation of the antitrust laws. It turned out that once these restrictions were removed, nothing much happened because the customers gained enormously from having a one end to another end kind of supply from a given supplier. And so the government, finding that its remedies, quote unquote, didn't do any good, what they did is they eventually ordered the breakup of the company into three competing branches, none of which were economically viable. And they did this just at the time that foreign competition was coming in anyhow. So that was, I think, widely regarded as a very sorrowful situation of government overreaching. In vertical arrangements, generally speaking, the contractual provisions cause little harm, and by the same token, they generally do relatively little by way of benefit, so the well-advised firm is often told, just get rid of the terms because you're not going to hurt your market position much anyhow.
Well, now, Professor, these older cases, meatpacking, shoes, these are much more traditional markets. Isn't the case a little different with some of the more modern cases, such as AT&T and Microsoft, where you're dealing with networks and network effects?
Absolutely. The key point about this is that the older cases are typically situations where competitive markets can arise when new independent firms come into play. And that was very obviously true with respect to the Packers. And it certainly was not impossible for anybody else to assemble another patent pool in order to create a shoe company to do into business against United Shoe. In a network industry, the test is that everybody who wants to use the network has to have access to every other customer on the network. And therefore, if you have competitive firms, you have to get a way to link them together. And the only way that you will find to do this is through some degree of coercive activity on the part of government. And the key question is, what's the optimal form of coercion to take place? And one strategy, which was the original strategy for AT&T, was to create one big happy family under the AT&T Bell umbrella so that everybody was essentially a Bell customer. And this did have a way to eliminate all the interaction and intercommunications problems, but it meant that there was no competition at the consumer end, and you had to rely on a very erratic system of rate regulation to keep things in order. A second solution that could have been done was to have an obligation which says that you could not discriminate by refusing connections to competitors. So this would be essentially an interconnection solution, which said that AT&T had to make its system available to a foreigner who could meet all of its tests with respect to system operations so that they couldn't blow the whole thing up. And this was the proposal that probably would have taken place in the 1970s if the FCC had been allowed to run its course. And my view is it would have resulted in a fairly rapid shrinkage of the AT&T system, nonetheless with relatively few dislocations. Once the antitrust breakup action was brought against AT&T in 1982, a peculiar union of a very conservative Bill Baxter in the Reagan Justice Department and, in fact, a very liberal judge, they broke it up in the wrong way. And so they created all sorts of frictions in trying to link together the local exchange carriers with the long-distance carriers at the top end. And in the end, there were a whole rapid series of mergers so that AT&T is back again as an integrated company supplying both local and long-term situations. And the lesson that you learn from this is that ambitious remedies usually go astray. And once you got down the path with respect to the consent decree, the Telecommunications Act aggravated the difficulties in 1996. And it's only now, about 11 years after the statute, that we're finally beginning to get past all of that through a succession, oddly enough, of mergers coupled with new entry of integrated companies. Microsoft is also effectively a network industry. Its server has a dominant position. And the rather simple solution that was eventually hit by the antitrust authorities in this country was to say that it had to supply interconnections to all rival suppliers of various kinds of equipments that could run on top of the Microsoft system. And the original consent decrees were way off base, in my judgment, because they contemplated breaking up the company in ways that were counterproductive. But by the time this thing went up and down throughout the courts, people recognized that Microsoft did provide an advantage to its own consumers by offering integrated products, and that if you allowed the interconnections, you would start to see a greater increase in the number of applications available. How much? Well, it's very hard to say, because one of the things that we know is that the integrated system that Microsoft supplies will have efficiency advantages, given the way in which it's designed together from the ground up, even over the additions that the other people want to put on. So that there's a kind of a strong price pressure by allowing the interconnections, but you're not going to see a great transformation, probably because there's no great transformation to be had. What is clear is that uneasy lies the head that wears the crown, because the danger to a company like Microsoft comes from the fact that a totally new technology can displace it, much the way its own operating system displaced IBM back in the early 1980s. So the lesson that you learn from all of this when you're dealing with consent decrees is keep them short, keep them simple, put fairly strict time limitations on them, and try and tailor very tightly the violation and the remedy all as one. And the prediction that I would make, given the current issue, is that Microsoft has played by the rules of the consent decree that was entered into in 2002. It was a 5-year decree. It will take a very heavy burden on the states, not the federal government, which is not interested in this, in order to get its extension. And I think it will be allowed to die.
Thank you very much, Professor Epstein. This concludes our podcast today, and it concludes our fall series with visiting scholar Richard Epstein on law litigation and state power. This podcast and our others are available on our Manhattan Institute website, pointoflaw.com.